Feminist Internet is a group of artists and designers working to advance internet equalities for women and other marginalized groups through critical practice. The Feminist Internet podcast is commissioned and produced by Somerset House Studios with the support of the University of the Arts London Creative Computing Institute. Over the series, it will explore the theme of recoding spaces, both online and offline, with the aim of diversifying internet spaces metaphorically, physically, and digitally, intercepting homogenous zones and breaking the filter bubble. The podcast aims to not only expose these spaces, but to regenerate them in new and inclusive ways.
The Feminist Internet Podcast.
Recoding music, has the internet truly brought autonomy to musicians?
Listening to music can be one of the most powerful and identity-forming experiences. It's so common to hear that the first time someone saw their own sexuality, background, or experience represented and understood was through music. And for artists, it can be the ultimate form of self-expression. Broad representation within music is life-affirming.
The internet holds huge potential for gender equality, positive social change, and creativity for the music industry. Now more than ever, artists and listeners have the opportunity to form affirming communities where they can feel visible and represented. Social media has also given artists more control over their own narrative and public image. The internet has drastically altered the way we access, create, and publish music. In some ways, the internet has allowed marginalized groups within the industry to become inspired and create without barriers.
However, despite these seemingly positive gains, the internet has also reproduced and perhaps even intensified issues of equality within the industry. Women, non-binary folk, and people from ethnic minorities are still objectified, typecast, and vastly underrepresented within the industry at all levels.
For example, a total of 899 individuals were nominated for a Grammy Award between 2013 and 2018. 90.7% of those were male, and 9.3% of them were women.
Women make up only 30% of the music industry workforce.
And out of a study of 600 of the most popular songs over 2012 and 2017, only 2% of these songs were produced by women. The internet has also created a set of new dilemmas for the music industry. Streaming service has vastly altered the way in which music is consumed and valued. For example, it takes 279 streams of a song to earn the artist and their team $1. Increasingly, these large corporations are turning music into content and encouraging the monetization of creativity and representation, especially for marginalized groups.
Given the power that huge streaming companies have over us, we have to question the agendas they have when it comes to how we consume and value music. We need to look at the entanglement of the music experience with capitalist gain and come up with alternatives. How can we, as artists and as listeners, reclaim some of that power? We'll be speaking today to Terry Tildesley from Resonate, journalist Liz Pelly, Professor Mick Grierson, and music collective Siren, all individuals who are challenging music's power structures and imagining how we might move towards a fairer and more diverse music industry.
The Feminist Internet Podcast.
Journalist Liz Pelly is sceptical when it comes to streaming platform recommendations and tailored playlists. Are branded, supposedly inclusive campaigns and playlists really trying to diversify the music scene? Or are they simply monetizing inclusivity?
My name is Liz Pelly. I'm a music and culture journalist based in New York. For the past few years, I have been focusing on music streaming and Spotify and the ways that the platform economy is reshaping music. So specifically, I've been doing a lot of writing about Spotify. About a year ago, it was last February, actually, I was interested in exploring gender bias on Spotify and particularly on the most popular playlists across the platform. So I made a brand new Spotify account, and for 1 month from that account, I decided that I was just going to listen to what Spotify told me to listen to. So I wanted to give a picture of if someone made a Spotify account and they were just listening to exactly what Spotify told them to listen to, you know, what would the gender disparity of that listening look like, ranging from what appears on the most popular curated playlists, and then also looking at what subsequently would be served to them on algorithmic playlists like Discover Weekly. So on Spotify, there are lots of different types of playlists. There are playlists that are curated by editors, and then there are also different algorithmic recommendation tools like Discover Weekly and Release Radar and Your Daily Mix. So I focused on listening to the playlists, Today's Top Hits, New Music Friday, Rap Caviar, Rock This, Vivo Latino, and Hot Country. I think that's all of them. I took a, you know, downloaded spreadsheets of everything that was on those playlists for the month that I listened, and spent a lot of time fact-checking and looking at the gender discrepancy amongst artists, and found the playlists to be staggeringly male-dominated. So on a playlist like Today's Tip Hits, for example, I found, you know, over 60% of the artists represented to be by men as elite artists. And on New Music Friday, I found over 70% male artists. On Rap Caviar, throughout the listening experiment, there was only one woman-led track that appeared. And, you know, things were similarly bleak on the other playlists I listened to as well. So then I also looked at the algorithmic playlists, Discover Weekly specifically, and found the percentage of women artists that I was serviced to be almost exactly the same as in comparison to the total percentage on the curated playlists. At a certain point, there was this idea that streaming platforms like created value by providing access to 30 million tracks, or because, you know, listeners could pay one subscription fee and have access to all of this music. But if you look at what these platforms actually consider to be like their most valuable products, or the sort of like the product that they're selling, it has a lot more to do with discovery tools and their playlist brands, the playlists that become sort of like the flagship brands that you see when you open the platform and you look at the front browse or homepage. It's interesting. I wrote this piece last year called Stream Bait Pop, where I was looking at the types of music that seemed to be doing well in this environment, and spoke with a producer who had years of experience making, you know, what he called Spotify music. He would often be going into sessions, writing music, and hear things like, oh, we want to make a Spotify song, and how that often was this sort of chill, sad girl music, as this producer explained it to me. And I was thinking about how the Spotify sound is so tied to things like chill and to mood and affect, and that totally makes sense when you think about the way that the rise of playlists has led to this recontextualizing of music in those types of categories. You know, a really interesting thing to consider is the rise of a trend like chill on Spotify, which is really big. You know, oftentimes when you open up Spotify, there's, you know, 8 different playlists at the top of the page that they're particularly pushing at any given time of the day. And it's really common to see things like chill vibes or chill hits. Or to me, you know, there's like a big connection between those sorts of mood and affect related trends and types of music that has become to come to be defined as Spotify core, or as I called it, stream bait. A lot of these trends that have been rising in the wake of the streaming era are, you know, or have way more to do with this idea of platform culture than they have to do with music culture. It's about what services the platform, what creates value for the platform, what will get people to continue using these platforms. And a lot of what this boils down to is creating fodder for what's essentially a large advertising mechanism. So I think that in terms of young people on the platforms in particular, I think that, you know, across the board, there's a lot of work to be done in terms of digital literacy and teaching kids about how advertising works online on Instagram, Facebook, with influencers. You know, there's like a ton of things that are important to be thinking about, but I also think that those apply just as much to adults and not just like young people growing up with the platform, but people who are using the platforms that, you know, also have had times in their life where music and culture wasn't totally ruled by the platform economy. But something that I think is, you know, really important for people of all ages to remember is that within this economy that we all have personal agency, and that even when it seems like, you know, I feel like there's sometimes can be a sense of helplessness about doing anything about the fact that these platforms have come to have so much power over our lives and culture and music. But there are, you know, other ways to interact with music. There are other platforms. There are, you know, still other things that we can do to engage with music outside of these systems, whether that's choosing to buy an album that you like on a platform like Bandcamp instead, or, you know, choosing to buy a copy from a band at a show, or to talk to your friends about what music they're listening to. Like, these things that seem small actually do lead to more meaningful experiences, or like create more meaningful relationships with music, rather than the utter devaluing of music that is happening on platforms like Spotify. You know, remember all of the other ways of interacting with music that are possible. There's this big question of like what it means to be independent today. And I do think that there needs to be sort of like a strong culture of platform skepticism baked into, you know, what it means to be independent or, you know, part of a community. The whole infrastructure that supports independent music right now is in flux because of the changing economy of independent music. And I feel like the more like conversation that there is about it, and the more especially like talking about things that actually would serve independent artists, and starting to like think critically about what types of platforms would actually be not only useful but like interesting from the perspective of artists and fans alike.
So how do we move forward from this? If we're concerned about the motives of big streaming corporations when it comes to diversity, accessibility, and fair pay, how do we do things differently for the future? Emerging platform models such as Resonate could provide us with an alternative.
I'm Terry Tilsley. I'm a musician, producer, curator, and I'm chair of the board at Resonate. Resonate is an ethical music streaming cooperative, and the idea is to create a much fairer, more transparent ecosystem to support musicians at a time when things are often very difficult for them generally. The stream-to-own model is a way of making sure that artists get paid very transparently, because it's a system of micropayments. Each time a song gets played, the artist gets a small amount. That increases so that after a certain number of plays, you as a listener can download the track. So what that means is every artist gets paid the same, and they can see that they're getting paid the same. And for a listener, it means you have a much more direct relationship with the artist. You can see that your money is going to the person that you're playing the most. It's a bit like pay as you go. So you don't have to sign up for a particularly expensive subscription in order to start listening. We're harnessing blockchain technology, but we're not launched on blockchain yet. So our beta player, which has about 10,000 tracks on, is already operational. And all our development is blockchain ready, so that when there is a properly scalable blockchain, which we hope will be very soon, we can go onto it. Blockchain, it's best described as a distributed ledger or database. And there's a very nice description from a blockchain writer called Marcus O'Dare, where he says it's like a Google document without Google. So you have one source of truth, and it's shareable, and you don't have a corporate middleman. And what is exciting about blockchain is what it enables you to do in many spheres, but particularly in music and the music industry, because it enables fair and quick payments. You can have much better metadata in your tracks. Now, that sounds dry, but it is actually crucial to musicians getting paid properly, because there's a lot of money swirling around in collection societies and different parts of the world that just doesn't reach the musicians who've created the music. And there's an organisation, an electronic music organisation called FM. They have worked out that about £100 million a year doesn't go to the electronic music artists who should be having it, because the tracks can't be identified properly. So there's a lot of ways in which blockchain is, you know, has huge potential for changing things in the music industry. There is a sort of trend towards homogenization of music, if you like, because if your music fits a particular genre and particular genre playlist very nicely, you're more likely to get it in a playlist. And I think we do need to be questioning whether that's just going to mean everyone's going to try and do things in the same way. Martin Ware, who founded the Human League in Heaven 17, had a really good term for it. He says, you know, there's blandification going on. What is the overall effect on music in terms of making things very sort of dull, and also not allowing access to underrepresented artists? I think curation is really, really important. And we've had debates within Resonate about algorithms versus human curation. And we're still developing our curation systems, but human curation is definitely the winner as far as we're concerned. And also, we want to make sure that we work with all kinds of groups across genres, across local communities, so that, you know, we do get a wide range of music. But it is also something people actively want. I think one of the most exciting things about being part of Resonate is that it does offer such hope. I mean, we're all hopeful, but also we are already very much inspiring musicians, labels and so on to be part of it, because they want to see change. They haven't seen many avenues open to them to try and create change. And it is a way of affecting change. So at the moment we have about 700 labels, about 4,000 artists, and we haven't fully launched yet, and we haven't done full marketing campaign. So that's mostly through outreach and things going viral. And I think it does offer an opportunity for equality and fairness to be hardwired in to the technology, but also for us to be having a constant dialogue with our members. And we're very open to people's ideas. We're launching new discussion channels where people can have input. So it is very much a new way of doing things. And I think that does offer hope. And beyond the music industry too, I mean, what's been noticeable when I've been at Platform Cooperative and Cooperative events is people are very excited by this idea of a fairer way of doing business generally. It's certainly true that brands and corporations can often find some way of doing something, and it's all about them and not really about the community they're purporting to serve and about representation. And that's why I think it's very important to have an organisation like ours that's a cooperative and genuinely reflects what's happening, particularly at grassroots level, because that's where there's so much exciting music going on, particularly made by women. And there's a lot of organisations that are promoting live music, whether it's Loud Women, Get In Her Ears, or we have the Omni Collective. You know, there's lots of stuff out there that just isn't reflected. And the one thing I should say is that another problem with having a model so dominated by Spotify is that it's not just confined to Spotify, because if festival bookers and radio presenters or producers are choosing people based on Spotify statistics, then you're magnifying the effect of women not making it through to playlists in the first place. A lot of artists feel they can't do anything to jeopardize their relationship with Spotify.
The Feminist Internet Podcast.
Moonbow is an artist and member of Siren, a collective challenging preconceptions within dance music whilst bringing to the fore those underrepresented in the scene.
Before Siren started, I'd been producing music on my own for a couple of years, but I just didn't feel like I knew anyone else that I related to who made music. And I think without the internet, I probably wouldn't have found like that kind of community, which is cool. The internet, I think, has really given a lot of more marginalised people the autonomy to kind of be like, this is what I do, and for everyone to sort of like rise each other up a little bit.
How do artists avoid being drowned out by that kind of algorithmic choice?
John Perry Barlow wrote this Declaration of the Independence of Cyberspace in 1996, and it was kind of this manifesto that talked about how amazing it was that cyberspace could be this ungoverned space where we're free to be who we want to be. Whereas I think, especially like more and more recently, the online world's kind of being infiltrated by this capitalization, and that we can see how like paid advertising and the algorithms that prioritize paid advertising is really kind of changing the landscape of our news feed and the sort of biased stories that we consume and whose voices get prioritized, which tends to be those people who are financially privileged. So there was this moment of being able to like rise through the noise, and now capitalism's kind of trying to destroy it. The Shape of Sound was a project that Siren did in collaboration with Somerset House Studios. It premiered as part of Assembly Festival in November, and then it also premiered online in January. And the idea behind it was that we wanted to do a series of like 10-15 minute long videos that show various artists' live performances. And because we were starting this associate artist residency with Somerset House, we thought it would really make sense to film it at Somerset House, especially because they have some like really amazing rooms in the building. In the DJ world, you make mixes or you do radio shows and they go online, and they basically kind of act as a bit of a taster to what you would play in a club, essentially. Whereas I think we felt there wasn't really so much of an equivalent for artists who perform live, so that people can kind of know what their live set's going to be, especially maybe people who want to book them. Like, I think a lot of festival applications now ask artists if they can send a video of them performing live, because it's completely different to recorded material often as well, especially if that person does a lot of improvisation or kind of choreography or visual stuff. Like, we were aware that there's various other platforms that kind of do similar things, for example Boiler Room, but I think we wanted to maybe remove the sort of audience element of it and create this sort of like one-off thing that interacted with the space a bit more. Online, like, you really can carve out and curate that space so much more now, and I think marginalised people really in particular benefit from this, really, because of not being able to sort of be platformed like so much historically. Something that Siren as a collective, like we always say, is that the problem isn't that marginalised people don't exist, it's just that we're not visible. Yeah, that's just the bottom line, really. So the internet kind of has been really helpful in making that a bit clearer. I do think that like a lot of these larger platforms and corporations, if we even want to work with them, could work a little bit harder to try and find some of these artists and like then use their power to make them visible, because I think quite often these, especially very like branded, commercialized kind of music platforms, they tend to sort of tag on to what's hype and kind of wait for other more grassroots organizations to basically do the research, bring out the underrepresented artists, and then kind of when those artists no longer seem to be a risk, then they're like, okay, now we'll book them. It's not hard to like find amazing artists on SoundCloud, and there's so many of them. I'm amazed that some people still kind of fly under the radar. even the representation of trans people and the representation of non-binary people tends to often be skewed towards a certain archetype, which I think the very nature of being like gender fluid is to not be put within a box of being one binary thing each day. Marginalized voices like deserve to be up there with like the big boys, you know? We don't need like some separate event that is marketed to sort of like seem like they care about politics. Yeah, even more so, it's important to be able to like construct your narrative in specific genres. Not everyone has the sort of ability to like access these kinds of spaces where you can like schmooze and mingle with industry people, and some people don't, you know, suffer from anxiety or mental health issues that mean they can't do that, even though when it comes to actually doing the work, like, they're on it and they're great at it. But it's just that sort of like marketing yourself in person thing, like, isn't for everyone. So it's nice that the internet provides this kind of autonomy for people to be able to just present their work how they want. I kind of feel like, as a non-binary artist, we're so barely represented as it is. I want to feel like proud of who I am and like not hide who that is, you know, because that could inspire like one small child somewhere through relating to like seeing that person, you know. So I don't think I would have started making music if it wasn't for seeing like a lot of other female and non-binary artists online making mistakes in like quite a like fearless and punk way, whereas previously like so many of the artists pre-internet would be very like polished and you'd be like, how on earth did they do that? I could never do that. And it's so nice to see the very nuanced and vulnerable sides of people through the internet and feel inspired by that, I guess.
There are other ways too that the digital can impact how we make and consume music. Mick Grierson's work with the Creative Computing Institute shows us how technology can alter the way we understand music and enhance our access to music-making tools.
I'm Professor Mick Grierson, and I'm the research leader at the new Creative Computing Institute. So about 18 months ago, I met a few people from Google, and Massive Attack had been in touch with Google about doing a project. They kind of put us together and said, why don't you guys talk to these guys, because they've been working on something for a long time. We had a visit from Massive Attack in the lab. We talked about the sorts of things they wanted to do with the album Mezzanine to celebrate its 20th anniversary. And we played them some stuff that I'd been working on, and we talked about how we might collaborate. And that developed into a project around trying to find, yeah, a new way to interpret Mezzanine through artificial intelligence and machine learning as a way to celebrate it. And then that ended up in a kind of Barbican project. Barbican are doing a large exhibition called AI More Than Human. Massive Attack are quite sort of tuned in to contemporary problems around technology, contemporary issues and ethical considerations, social considerations around machine learning and artificial intelligence. One of the things which is interesting about the exhibition itself, which is really interesting, is that this theme of the notion of what we think of as ghostly other kind of characters or creatures in the world and how they impact on us. And these are kind of, if you think about religion, for example, or forms of, or ghosts, these things are imaginary things that we've invented, that we've created, but that we think have agency that controls us. And AI is sort of similar to that. It's thought of as a thing which is outside of us, which is controlling us and making us do things. But the truth is, we invented it, and it's doing exactly what we ask it to do. And that's a much more important thing to realize. People who haven't heard Massive Attack's music are going to hear it in a very new way. And they're going to hear it through this lens of artificial intelligence and machine learning. It will sound very different. It will sound much more contemporary. And then sometimes it sounds quite mechanistic. And it represents that kind of voice of the AI, if you like. But at the same time, it's all driven by people's interaction with the system. So it's all generated by those people who walk into the installation. So it's the same thing. You know, this thing seems like an intelligence that's entirely alien to us, but actually it's completely controlled by people.
AI is so often, I suppose, construed as this, it can be an almost a malevolent force because of that idea that it's othered, it's this kind of external ghost type character. How do we maintain accessibility and user-friendliness in that sort of system going forward?
The reason why we need to worry about AI isn't because it's powerful, it's because that power is somewhat shepherded by large technology companies and governments. And that's, you know, it's understandable because it's very expensive to get to the stage that we're at now. And if it wasn't for the investment of large technology companies, we wouldn't have any of these technologies. Governments could have made investments in this technology sooner, but they didn't because of their lack of vision. And that's the truth. The work which has gone into Google's AI, all that work is actually decades old. It's just nobody really had the infrastructure and the will to make it happen. There's no necessarily new maths in much of what is being done. There's just considerable engineering effort. And so it could have happened at any time. The power was kind of there. The knowledge was sort of there. It just wasn't, it hadn't percolated into something which was really happening. And those people who did understand it weren't really listened to. And a lot of them were British, actually. This is by way of saying that even when that technology is there and it's accessible, it's still inaccessible because the knowledge to understand its power isn't widely grasped. But now we grasp this power because it surrounds us and everything that we do. We understand the power of it. But even so, efforts to give us control over that power are likely to be frustrated by a lack of technical expertise on our part and a lack of understanding of what's required to put it in our hands by those who do understand it. So there's a need to build more accessible tools to allow people other than governments and technology companies to generate and control and deliver their own AI that they're in charge of, that they are training, that represents their views and their biases. Eliminating views and biases from AI, I'm not saying it's impossible. I'm just saying that people aren't going to do it. I think it's important to try. I'm not saying don't try, but I'm saying it's as important to try to eliminate bias as it is to try to get control of systems to represent you.
That idea of us taking more control technologically is very interesting. I also wonder if that is then going to make it more easy for people to create music and, you know, from a very, you know, someone who has very little experience.
That's always been the case. To be honest, music technology has always been about making music more accessible. And that's something which I really believe in. I've spent a lot of time working with the learning disabled communities, autistic people that I work with. We work together a lot, and it's kind of a co-production idea where we try to build new tools that make it easier for everybody to make music, because there's so much to gain from making music with people. And also, you learn such a lot about a person when you play music with them. It's a very special, magical thing, and why shouldn't it be easy? Regardless of AI, it's always been easy to use technology to make things more accessible. It's just the will isn't there. People don't understand that it's actually very good to make an instrument which is simple. It actually creates beautiful and refined processes. There's an adage in the musical community, the instrument building community, particularly the technology community, which is low threshold, high ceiling. And what that means is anyone should be able to get started, but you should be able to get really good at it if you want. And I think that's a great maxim. It's a great way of seeing how people should interact with music. It's a community thing. It's not something that we shouldn't be praying to musical gods. We shouldn't be doing that. We should be enjoying making music together. And if technology can help us to do that, we should definitely make that technology. In order to make the world a better place, we can do one really good thing, I think, without trying to sound too preachy, and we could just make more culture. And the more people who make more culture, the better I think we'll be. I think it's as simple as that. Communities of music practice, I'm thinking about established music practice that we consider to be musical and on a kind of on a cultural level. Often they're not that musical in the way that we might expect. You know, I love orchestral music, and I have a lot of friends who are great orchestral performers and some composers. But often a lot of those orchestras are playing the same 150 pieces of music over and over again. That's okay. It's a particular kind of culture, and that's fine. But there's a lot to be said for making very, very different things that don't fit in with existing narratives of the way the world should be represented. Imagination can create new technologies if we can give people tools to allow them to do that, to make a kind of representation of the world that fits their own worldview and could be radically different. And they might, yes, as you say, get rejected from a lot of other communities and then build their own community. And that's what it's for. That's what all technology is for is an extension of your identity and your vision. And I think it's the same with AI. We need to build AI tools that allow people to do that.
I find it reassuring to know that there are people in the music industry who are well aware of its problem with representation and who are working to change the scene. Something I've certainly taken away from these chats is an awareness of my own listening habits and how active the platforms I'm using actually are, sometimes in a way that will limit my musical listening landscape if it means generating a profit at their end. It's also interesting to note that sometimes what looks like an inclusivity campaign is actually using a marginalised group as a short-term financial opportunity, such as Smirnoff's gender equality campaign with Spotify, which ultimately, as Liz points out in her writing, is just a company trying to make more women buy vodka.
I hope we begin to see the growing shift in consciousness towards ethical consumption spread across the music industry, and that we can become more skilled as consumers in spotting the difference between faux ethical promotion and real ethical transformation. I also think that the involvement of tech and AI can seem overwhelming, but I almost feel spurred on to go against the algorithm-driven grain even more and actively explore platforms that prioritise fairness and accessibility. We can keep promoting music outside of what we're prescribed, and we can keep relentlessly carving out digital space for those who are marginalised. By giving them a seat at the table and listening to what they have to say, that's how the music industry narrative can change.
Some